It's Richarlison. Oh, they should have been in front there, but for some miraculous goalkeeping from Hamer. He's been in super form tonight, Ben Hamer. Terrific save onto the woodwork. Wonderful effort. Fingertips from the goalkeeper.
Hello and welcome to the Goalkeepers Union podcast. Me, Matt Beadle, here with the voice of goalkeeping, Richard Lee.
Hello there.
How have you been?
Oh, I see what you've done there.
Very clever.
Very, very clever.
That's as good as the gags are going to get, I think, on this one. This week's guest is a man who started at Reading, excelled at Charlton and stepped up to the Premier League with Leicester and then Huddersfield. He's bagged two promotions. He's been named in a PFA Team of the Year. He's even won a Puma Golden Glove. And correct me if I'm wrong here, but he's one of a number of guests we've had on this very podcast to have dislodged Richard Lee from the number one spot. Ben Hamer, welcome to the Goalkeepers Union podcast.
Cheers, you had to get that one in, didn't you?
Oh, mate, we've got to start strong.
Cheers, mate.
I'm sure we've got plenty of stories on Mr. Richard Lee as we get into the podcast. But first and foremost, Ben, I've got to ask, mate, how's the beard?
Oh, it's very short now. It's not nowhere near as big as it used to be back in the Leicester days. I think Nigel Pearson told me to cut it off one time and he scared me that much that I just got rid of it.
It was epic, wasn't it? There are a series of goalkeepers now who tend to grow these beards. I'm not going to say that it was wispy. It was very pointy.
Yeah, I think I just there was absolutely no style with it, to be honest. I think I was just growing it. Great. I think it was a bit of a fad back in that time where everyone was like trying to grow the beards. I remember being at Charlton and we had Ben Anick as well at Charlton at the time, and I think we were growing it at the same time. So I think we looked like twins, to be fair, and we were going out quite a lot together as well. So yeah, it was a bit of a strange one, that. But when I look back now at the photos, I'm thinking, what were you doing? But, yeah, these things happen, don't they, in life? You make mistakes and then you learn from them.
You do, mate. Richard Lee still hasn't learned from his mistakes with regards to facial hair, but we'll let that one slide. Declan Rudd, to be fair, is another one in the Championship with Preston.
He's gone huge now.
He's massive.
Yeah,
yeah. Both of them. I think Conor Ripley is doing it as well.
Mm. I think they're a bit behind the times, to be honest, but we'll let him crack on, eh?
And we'll not dispel a myth, but we spoke to Paul Robinson on this podcast, and on his Wikipedia page, various sources claim that he can speak Italian, fluent Italian. He said that is complete and utter nonsense. I know for yourself, you grew up in Germany. We didn't get a chance to speak about this with Adam Davies. We missed that opportunity. So I'm going to start and do it with you, Ben. Can you speak fluent German?
I can speak it, yeah. I can speak German. Not to the level I used to be at when I was younger, but yeah, can still hold a conversation in German if I needed to, yeah. So,
are you serious? Was I with you for that period of time and I had no idea that you could speak German?
Well, you obviously didn't want to get to know me enough, you know what I mean?
Mate, I had no idea. I'm actually really impressed.
Yeah, no, I lived there from 2 to about 8 years old. So my actual first language when I started talking was German, because my parents threw me into a German kindergarten. So I think my mum was a bit devastated when she slung me in there. But she said, like, within about 2 weeks, I was like a sponge. And, I was speaking German, obviously, as a kid. So, yeah, I went to German school to start off with. And then, obviously, when we come back to England at 8, I had to then do English lessons because my German was better than my English, so that was a bit mad, mate. Yeah, so obviously coming back to the English school system, and I was a bit behind everyone. So because you don't do it at school, you don't speak to other people with that language. Obviously, growing up in England, you then tend to forget it.
Yeah, of course.
So obviously, like now, it's nowhere near as good as it was when I was like eight years old, which is crazy. But like I said. When I went to Huddersfield last year, David Wagner was the manager, and I could have bits and pieces of conversation with him in German. So it's quite a cool string to have to your bow, to be fair. So
definitely, and now you're an A-star student in English as well.
We'll go that far, mate.
Can't believe you didn't know this, Rich. See, there's a lot more to people. You should find these things out.
It just shows all of our conversations were very much surface level for those few months, I think.
I think the football changing room as well. There's nothing really serious to get spoke about. It's all quite banter filled, and I don't want to go into too much detail, but the most amazing thing I found about Richard was the thing between his legs.
Oh, my God.
All right, yeah, we'll quickly move on. Didn't see that one coming. I'm not going to lie to you. We'll quickly move on. In fact, we'll stick with the whole German theme, because growing up in Germany, you know, we speak to a lot of goalkeepers about their idols growing up here. What was it like for you? I imagine it was the likes of Oliver Kahn at the time.
Yeah, my dad used to take me to the Olympic Stadium, because we lived on the outskirts of Munich, so nearly needed to obviously take me on the bus to the games, and it was really cheap actually to go and watch games over there. I think it was like two quid to go and watch a Champions League game at the time. So he used to take me to go and watch them, and I used to just meticulously watch Oliver Kahn like doing his warm ups and stuff. And I think that's when I really found the love for it. I must have been about 5 years old, I think, and you know, I was watching him do his warm ups and stuff. And thinking, God, I want to do that. Do you know what I mean? It's quite crazy, really, to think that, you know, that early in age, someone has that much of a, you know, an effect on you, and like more like an inspiration, I guess. And then the next thing you're diving around in the garden and stuff, and you know, wanting your old man to go and take shots at you and stuff like that. So you just like replicating what he was doing, and so he was a massive inspiration to me growing up, because he used to watch everything he did in the games and stuff like that, rather than watching the game going on itself. I'd be, when the ball's up the other end, I'd be watching what Oliver Kahn was doing. Do you know what I mean? So, but he's obviously a great keeper and had an unbelievable career. So, yeah, not a bad keeper to be going and watching every week when you're living close by.
No, it's interesting that, because I remember going when I was younger. So I went to, must have been United versus Bayern Munich. And I always remember I went there really early, proper geeky kid, to watch Schmeichel and Kahn. And like, you've got two keepers, they've got two very different techniques. Oliver Kahn, he did as well, didn't he? He used to have the role. He was like, used to parry a lot, was so powerful, wasn't he, from memory. Like, was there anything from his game that you saw that you like particularly liked that you then took on into your game?
I wouldn't say so, because I think he's a bit more agile than what I am. But he said that, yeah, he had that role. So he'd spring, and then as soon as he hit the deck, you know, the Germans, they've got that mad role, haven't they, when they hit the deck. So I remember his kicking wasn't great, but then back in the day, it wasn't really a thing for keepers to be playing out and like, you know, like zinging the ball to the fullback and stuff like that. They should get it, like run to the edge of the box and just boot it as far as they could. So I think even they're playing Champions League level, and the keeper's not expected to be able to, you know, play out and stuff like that. They're just, you know, kicking it long. And I remember watching them against Ajax, Evelyn van der Sar. And I think, yeah, they're both just, you know, kicking the ball long every time they got it, from what I remember. And it's mad, really, how the game's evolved in the goalkeeping sense, and how, you know, how we need to, like, play out from the back now. And you know, it's better for the game, really, because, you know, I just think it looks better, do you know what I mean, rather than just slinging the ball away and giving the ball away, you know, keeping possession and stuff like that. You know, it's great.
Well, I wanted to touch on this with you, because you go back to your memory of me during our time at Brentford. I've got a couple of memories of you, a few memories of you, to be fair. Like, one was that me and Simon Moore would be doing weights and you'd be sat drinking a coffee in your shorts watching us for like half an hour, which I always found really amusing. The second, never fancy joining in, just sat there with a coffee, joining in the banter, just watching me and Si like sweat one out. But the other one was we played the five-a-sides, and to be honest, distribution was never a strength of mine, and certainly, like you mentioned, back in the Schmeichel Kahn days, no one really cared about it then. But I always remember playing the five-a-sides, and you'd be like, your distribution was phenomenal. You'd be doing a little side volley, like tiny little side volleys out to wingers in five-a-sides. And at the time, I remember thinking it was so different. And of course, the way the game's gone, you were a step ahead to some extent. What was it that, what was the influence there? Like, what allowed you to become as good as you were when it came to your side volley, your distribution at a younger age? Did you have an influence that really helped with that?
Oh, yeah. I was lucky, really, because when I was obviously coming through the system at Reading, and you know, I had a variety of keepers that I worked with, and you know, I had Marcus Hanneman, Adam Federici, Graham Stack. Adam Federici's at Stoke now. He was unbelievable at it, and I remember, and obviously Marcus Hanneman as well. He had it to a certain extent as well, but I think Feds was more intricate with it and could hit, you know, the fullback like say 20 yards away rather than throwing the ball out. It was like a quicker way of getting it to the fullback, like a little, you know, like a stab side volley. You know, I used to watch him and I used to be like, God, and I want a bit of that. You know, I need this in my locker. And I was like 17 at the time, and he was obviously, you know, he was quite a big inspiration for me as well, actually, Adam Federici, because he's you know, the work rate the guy's got, it was unbelievable. And I used to just watch what he did at training, and you know, try to, you know, replicate what he did, because I found what he did was really effective. So yeah, so I used to watch, obviously, Fez do the side volley. I said to him, look, I want to practice with you. I used to practice with him in the mornings, practice with him after training, and I still do it now. To be fair, I practice it every day now, and you know, it's a really good tool to have. I find if you need to, you know, find that quick low pass, you know, this is a different trajectory. You can hit, I mean, you can hit the side volley in many different ways. You can hit the fader. You can hit the little stab out to the fullback. You can, you know, hit the long one. And yeah, so I used to just practice with Feds every day, and he really had the perfect one, I thought. So yeah, just watched him meticulously, always practiced with him, and yeah, like I said, I think the thing with that is that the more you practice it, obviously, the better you get of it. So you know, obviously a big thing for me is just practice, and you know, in any situation you're in training, try and use it just to, you know, perfect that technique, because it is an art, really, I think, and you know, a lot of keepers find it hard to do, but once you get it, it's a really good tool to have in your locker.
It's funny, that's another similarity to Adam Davies, as it goes, because he said when he went into Stoke with Federici, the first thing he said to him was, I need to learn, I need to find out exactly how you do that.
Well, right, Sal Bibo was there, wasn't he, as well, like from memory. I always remember doing we played against Reading and watching him in the warm-up. It might have been you, I can't remember now, but whoever was doing the warm-up, just firing these side volleys back and forth, and it was very much at the start. And I remember Sal Bibo, that was quite a big thing of his. Was it him that taught that to you guys, or was it more so that it kind of like Adam had it already and it then infiltrated the rest of you?
Well, yeah, no, I think because obviously before Adam came, Marcus Hanneman was doing it on the regular anyway, so yeah. I'd seen, because we were playing a really counter-attacking brand of football under Steve Coppell, so every time Marcus Hanneman used to get it from across, and that, you know, the wingers would just bomb on, you have Glenn Little, Bobby Convey just burst on, and he'd always hit that side volley into the channel for the wingers, because, you know, we were very, you know, we were a very cross-based team, get the ball out wide, crosses into the box, and, you know, if you've got 15 entries from crosses, you're more likely to score a goal from that. That was kind of like their viewing on it. So, yeah, like, I used to watch Hanneman do it quite a lot, and then obviously Feds came in, but Feds had it, like, you know, he just had it, do you know what I mean? Whereas, you know, the Marcus one was quite a big lad. He couldn't get his hips up as high as what Feds could. And, yeah, so I just decided to have a look at Feds with that one. And, yeah, Sal obviously worked with us with it every day. And, yeah, I think that's a big thing. I think it's the way the team plays as well. If you're a counter-attacking team and your keeper needs to have that, then obviously he's going to work on it with you a lot. So, yeah, Sal did do a lot of work with that with us. And, like I said, before the games and the warm-ups and stuff, you know, we'd be firing side volleys to each other. Probably more for showing off, I'd say. But at the end of a warm up. But obviously, like I said, brilliant tool, and it's quite a big thing now, I think, with the goalkeepers, isn't it?
We're going to get on to your career, but we've got to quickly start with Brentford. I know you started your career with Reading, but spent a few times on loan with Brentford. You got the Golden Glove in that 08-09 season, as I said, 20 clean sheets as the Bees went up from League Two. But I quickly want to touch on one fixture in particular a couple of years later. You were on the bench for this one. It was an EFL Trophy game between Brentford and Charlton, December 2010. Now, Ben, I don't know whether you remember this as well as the man sitting opposite me, but he does not shut up about it.
Oh, mate, that was unbelievable, wasn't it? It was unbelievable. Yeah, three penalty saves, wasn't it?
Was it three, was it?
It was three.
Just the three, wasn't it? Just the three. Yeah, I mean, Rich had obviously had this thing with penalties where he I've got to be honest, he was amazing. He just, every time someone had a penalty, you think he was going to save it. And I think he actually put that into that, he planted that seed into the players he was facing in the penalties. I think they knew about him as well. And, you know, I think, you know, it did put him off when they were taking penalties against him, because he had such a great record. But, yeah, that was pretty mad night as well, actually. But I remember just before that we played Everton, or I might have been just after, and he saved a couple of penalties in the Everton game as well. And I remember being buzzing for you, Rich, actually, because I think when I came in, you'd kind of been written off by the manager.
Yeah, that's
and,
right.
And from pre-season, and obviously then I worked with you, and I'd spoke to you after the Everton game anyway about what I thought, how you've been doing. And I just thought you were a solid keeper, and I thought, why has he brought me here? Because he's actually really good, like, especially in training. You're an excellent trainer. And I just love seeing people do well when they've been written off. And I remember when you were saving the penalties in the Everton game and the Charlton game, I was actually like generally just like buzzing for you, because, you know, you've been written off and you'd showed what you were about. So, you know, I was happy for you.
Appreciate that, mate.
I was trying to get in the team at the time, but you know, quite young as well. But yeah, nah, I was buzzing for you at the time, mate.
Do you know what? It's actually, no, I appreciate that. And it is actually, this is the whole, there you go, goalkeepers union loving it. But this is one of the reasons we set this podcast up, was, and this is a great example, and we get loads of goalkeeper coaches listening, loads of young goalkeepers listening. For those that are listening, this is a good example where ultimately it was never me against you. And I think that's where, like, goalkeepers have that realisation that there is only one position that you can play. And look, you know, a good example, we got on great, obviously. We had a really nice union with Simon Morby in there as well. It was quite a nice little, quite a nice little group from memory. But that's it. Ultimately, the manager picks the team, and whether the goalkeeper agrees or not, what tends to happen is that goalkeepers do get on really well. And I remember that time, as much as I was frustrated with the manager at the time and felt that I'd been wronged and what have you.
Who was it at the time?
It was a guy called Andy Scott.
Scotty, wasn't it? Scotty.
It was, yeah, yeah. Who, in fairness, you know, I haven't really spoke to him since. Like, I've got no ill feeling towards him now. But at the time, that's it. You're fighting for that shirt, but it's never the fault of the other person. And it was just a really strange time from memory, because you obviously did really, really well when you played. And it was only because you got stuck on the M4 that I ended up getting a chance and finally got myself back in the team, if I remember rightly.
Yeah, that was it, wasn't it?
It was ridiculous. You got dropped because you ended up getting stuck on the M4 in some horrendous crash.
I remember actually turning up for a game, and I was panicking because I hate being late, mate. It's like one of my worst pet peeves is being late, because as soon as I know I'm going to be late, I start getting all panicky, mate, and I start getting all clammed up, because I just don't like being late for anything. So I remember getting there, got to the ground about 10 minutes before the warm-up, actually. So I wasn't even, do you know what I mean? I was there to do the warm-up, and I remember Scotty pulling me in the office, and he goes, "You ain't playing tonight." And I was like, what? I remember losing my, you know, like, just before, you obviously expect, you know, when you're preparing to play for a game, and then all of a sudden, you know, it gets, you get thrown off a little bit by saying you're not playing just before.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't know what to do with myself. And then I remember going out for the warm-up, and I think my head was just gone, mate. Even though I was, like, supposed to be getting you ready for the game, I think my head was just falling off. So from being late and then obviously then getting dropped. But then, mate, to be fair, you came in, I think. We'd done well. I remember playing Southampton away as well. And I mean, you had an absolute worldie at Southampton away. And I think that was, I think it was after that I just went and seen him and said, listen, like, I might as well go back to Reading here, because obviously you're doing great. And I was just kind of just sitting there. The whole reason was for me to come down there and play and stuff. And you were doing great, mate. So I was just like, yeah, I'll go back to Reading, and then you know, I'll try and go somewhere else. And I obviously went to Exeter after that. But good times, mate. I had a better spell the year before, or 2 years before, in League Two. But that was a nice experience. It's always nice to work with different keepers as well, because you know, you get to meet lots of different people in this game, when you're moving about and stuff. And you know, it's good to see other people training and the methods and that. So yeah, nice experience, mate, to be fair, working with you. So
cheers, dude.
Nothing but good memories.
See, mate, there you go. I teed him up for that
you
one,
did.
So you can thank me for that.
Every now and then.
Yeah. Thank you. I like the chat that you had with Andy Scott, though. Brutal honesty to just say, listen, I don't think that I need to be here. It's probably best that I move on.
Well, yeah, I think that's how it is, really, in football. I think if things ain't going your way, or you know, you've gone somewhere for a certain reason and it doesn't work out, then you know, we're all men at the end of the day. Do you know what I mean? We're not. There's no point in, you know, hiding from it or shying away from it. If you've got something you think you need to say, and you know, have it out in the open, then just go and say it, because you know, you just get yourself off, and then get yourself into another situation that can affect you positively, I guess. So I've never shied away from having them open chats. But but it's they're always good experiences, no matter what. If they go well or they go bad, it's always good experience.
But do you know, I'm going to add to that, because again, this podcast is, again, it's kind of educational as well for a lot of the people that listen, as much as it's interesting, some of the stories that come out. And actually, that's one of my biggest things. The lads that I work with now, it's one of the biggest things is don't be too nice. It's very easy to be nice and to be the pushover and to just, but ultimately, like, we're all fighting for the same thing. We want to get to the top of our game. Now, if you're sat there content as a number two, for instance, it's very, and I had that during my career at times when I was too comfortable being a number two. And before you know it, your career comes and goes, and you look back and think, do you know what? What if I'd have just been a little bit more assertive there? What if I'd gone and tell the manager at that point there, I have to play, or that, you know, I'm ready to play, or if I get dropped, don't take it too easily. And that's, again, a massive bit of advice I give anyone. If you do want to get to the top of your game, don't be too nice. You've got to be so assertive in everything you do. And you made the point there, we are all men at the end of the day. Like, if you want to be somebody who is strong and gets the opportunities, by being like that, you give yourself such a better chance of doing it.
I mean, yeah, I mean, obviously I found myself in a similar situation at Leicester, where I went from, you know, playing every week for 3 years to obviously going to Leicester. And, you know, I went there with, you know, a great deal of confidence, thinking, you know, that's what I went, that's what it was all building up to. I wanted to get to the Premier League, I wanted to play in the Premier League. And, you know, obviously went there, and obviously I had a guy in front of me who's world class, really, let's have it right, in Casper. And, you know, but I always believed that if I got the chance, I'd take it. Do you know what I mean? So I thought if I get in the bus, that's how my mentality was. I just thought, you know, I'll get the shirt and then I'll keep it. That's how I always thought. And I got in the team, and you know, through an injury for Casper, and I was playing and thought I was doing all right. I had a good run of games, about 8 games I think it was, before Christmas. And then he bought Schwarzer in, and I think we then played a game. We lost 1-0 against Stoke, and you know, I didn't do much wrong in the game. And we were playing Man United the week after, and I was buzzing to be playing Old Trafford in the Premier League, and so on and so forth. And you know, just before the game, he puts the team sheet up, and I'm not in it. And I was like, you know, I wasn't expecting that. So you, to do your art drops, don't you? Your art syncs, and then the week, I remember the week after, I thought, I'm not going to say anything before the game because the lads need to get ready and play and whatnot. And, you know, I went to see the manager on the Monday and basically just ask him why I'd been dropped and, you know, just basically tell him I wanted to play and I was dying to play in this team. And he just said, yeah, I think he's better than you. I think he's better than you. And I was like, all right, do you know what? I can deal with that. Mm-hmm. But because after then I've gone in, I think Casper's then got fit, and then I found myself training with the kids then after that. So I've gone from playing week in, week out in the Premier League with Leicester to then training with the kids for 6 months. So it was a crazy time, actually, because I wanted to do was play in the Premier League, and then I went from that, and then I thought, I've got in the manager's office, and now I'm training with the kids. So sometimes not advisable.
Do you? It was Nigel Pearson, I'm presuming, at the time. Do you appreciate the frank nature of a manager when he says things like that? Because whilst I suppose it's not so good for your confidence, it could also work the opposite way. He might have been thinking, listen, I'm going to tell him this to give him a kick up the backside and make him a better goalkeeper. Do you see it like that, or do you see it as a, all right, cheers, mate?
I always think honesty is the best policy. And, you know, sometimes they can tell you what you want, they think you want to hear to you know, appease you a little bit. But I always find if they tell you that, and you're like, right, okay, that's you know, that's honest. What can I do? What do you want me to do better? And at least that way you can come away from it a bit more positive, knowing what you need to work on to kick yourself back in his thoughts. Do you know what I mean? So I'd rather be told that he doesn't think I'm good enough and what do I need to work on, rather than be like, oh, no, you know, you're doing all right. I think you need to come out and, you know, just, you know, skirting the subject, really. But you've got to be strong mentally as well in football, you know, not take them sort of things to heart, because, you know, it's all about opinions of the game, and you can always improve. It's never, you know, it's never too late to improve your game. So, yeah, always take it on the chin and, you know, always ask what you think needs improving.
Great time to be at Leicester as well when you were there. Of course, in that great escape in that first season back in the Premier League. The following season, I know that, you know, you went out on loan to Forest. That one didn't work out for various reasons. Bristol City as well. The title-winning campaign, you didn't play any part in. Now, when you're part of a squad that does something so incredible like Leicester did, is it difficult when you're not playing a part? Because sometimes some players get, not mocked, but they almost get criticised for being in and around the squad because they haven't played a part in it. Was it a memorable time for you, that, or was it difficult because you weren't part of the squad that won that title?
I was really jealous, mate. Yeah, mate, I was brilliant, wasn't it? Yeah, and obviously I was in and around it every day, so you know, I was training with the lads and stuff. And do you know what? They had a big belief. They had a really big belief in them. And I remember, like, February, I think they went to Man City and won 3-1. And I remember from that point on, the lads were even saying, I remember in the group chats and stuff, they were like, we're going to win the league, lads. Like, we keep going, like, no matter what. Like, no one's getting in our way. And, you know, the belief they had to actually win the league from February, considering we just avoided relegation the season before. Yeah. And it was pretty much the same squad as well, you know. Apart from they brought in Kante, obviously. It was like a 12th man in there. He was like two people playing in your team. But the lads were amazing, and it was great to be involved with and see. And it didn't really sink in, actually, because I remember going in the next day and it didn't seem real that we'd actually won the Premier League, you know, little old Leicester. But obviously now they're a proper established Premier League football club, and, you know, looking to probably get in the Champions League again this season. So now really big football club, and, you know, the owners have done amazing things with it, and, you know, great people there, and always look back at it with fond memories, to be honest. I really love my time there.
Ross McCormack steps over. He's had a great season so far. Score a huge amount of goals. Can Ben Hamer make an absolute hero himself? Ross McCormack waits. The whistle goes. McCormack steps up, right-footed, hits it.
Yeah, what a save! What a save!
What a save! Ben Hamer! That's better than a goal! Get in there! Well done, Ben! And the players surround him. Concentrate, boys! It's a corner on the far left-hand side. Oh, wow! There are 2 minutes to go here. Leeds United are stunned. Ben Hamer dived to his right and has put it wide.
We often talk about goalkeepers' favourite saves on this podcast, Ben. And I was looking through the archives at some of your memorable stops over the years. There was one that I found quite funny. It's a very good save, by the way. It was against Leeds away at Elland Road. I think it was the 2013-14 season. It was when Charlton were battling to stay up. You'd moved to Charlton by this time. You saved a penalty right at the death from Ross McCormack. I don't need to tell you this. You know this very well yourself. But The brilliant thing I thought about the penalty was that, one, you whacked the post with your studs after you'd done it. Everybody was going crazy because it was a massive win at the time. I think because you were so fired up, Ross McCormack then came into the six-yard box. And without realising, for him, you instantly went to sort of give him a high five, a bit of a handshake, and he was not having a bar of it, mate.
Yeah, I think it's weird. You just said, everyone's trying to high five you, and everyone that's coming towards you. So I remember seeing, I think he actually gave me a high five, you know. why have I just given him a high five? To save his penalty. Yeah. But yeah, I think it was 94th minute, and you know what it's like, 94th minute, you're thinking, oh, Ross McCormack as well, he's prolific in that league, and you think he's going to score. But Ben Agge obviously guessed right at the time, and yeah, I think we won 1-0 in the end, so you know, it was a good result. But yeah, always nice to save a penalty. I haven't saved as many as Rich has, but you know, something I'm still working on. But yeah, always nice to save a penalty.
Hey, we got that in common, mate. We both got a Ross McCormack penalty save in the locker. There you go.
Whoa, don't mind it.
There you go.
Just quickly on the move to Charlton, we won't dwell too much on it, but it was funny how it worked out, wasn't it? We spoke to Nick Pope actually on this podcast, and it's quite ironic really, because I think you moved to the Valley in the same summer that he did from non-league at the time, but you were with Reading, you kept getting deals. Now, he kept getting deals eventually when he was at Charlton, didn't really end up playing too much for the club, and then moved to Burnley. It was the same situation for you at Reading. You kept getting deals, you'd been there since a kid, and then all of a sudden, you eventually get a move to Charlton. First season, you go up.
Yeah, it was crazy, really. At Reading, I think it's a difficult one. When you come up through the youth system, I think they always look at you as the young kid on the block. Do you know what I mean? You're the young lad, and I think you try and forge a path for yourself. And I think it's hard when you come through a system at a club. But yeah, like I said, I was obviously behind Federici at Reading, and you know, I at the time I was like, you know, wanting to play and whatnot. I'm probably quite naive actually, and I probably wasn't ready for the Championship at the time. You know, I was quite, you know, long, skinny, and you know, not very physical. And I remember always like knocking on Brian McDermott's door and saying, "Oh, come on, you know, I want to play. Any chance of getting?" And he's like, "Yeah, no, not yet, and all this, that, and the other." I remember playing a game at the end of the season, and the season was done, and we were playing Preston, I think it was, and I went in and said, "It's the last game. I really want to play. Will you play me?" And he's like, "No, you're not playing." And I was just like, "Right, I don't think it's going to go anywhere here." So I think I got onto the director of football and the agent, and I was like, So I still had a year left on the contract, I think, but I just wanted to go out and play. That was all I ever wanted to do. And I think, yeah, in the end, Sal Bibbo spoke to Ben Roberts at Charlton, and you know, they were after a key because Robbie Elliott was off to Newcastle, I think, at the time. And yeah, they made it happen, and you know, went down there, and yeah, went straight in, and then the rest was history. I really loved my time at Charlton. Great 3 years down in London, and you know, positive first year, and then we didn't really kick on, to be honest. We finished just outside the playoffs in the first season in the Championship. I thought, right, we'll kick on here next year, and then you know, went a bit to pot. No real signings came in, and we ended up just avoiding relegation. And then obviously that was my 3 years up then, and I moved on. But yeah, no, great times down at Charlton. Loved it, playing every week, and you know, that's all we ever want to go as goalkeepers is to be playing. And you know, a lot to Chris Powell for that, because he really gave me the confidence to go and flourish.
I read some quotes actually from Chris Powell on your time at the club, or at least towards the end of his tenure at the club. And just 2 months after Duchelet came in, of course, he was eventually sacked. He saw the writing on the wall, at least that's what he said. And there was a funny situation where he was basically told by the owner that he had to play a different keeper, that keeper being Johan Thuram Ullien, the cousin of Lilian Thuram, of course, the World Cup winner with France. What was that like for you? Because you've got a situation where Chris Powell clearly sees you as his number one, but the owner, who has his network of clubs and scouts that are around Europe, decides, no, I want my goalkeeper to be playing.
Well, I mean, I was actually injured at the time. I got injured in the November, and I was out till about February, March time. And yeah, they bought Thuram in. We had Ben Anik there at the time. And Ben Anik was playing and doing really well, and you know, and the gaffer was wanting to play him, and then obviously they bought Thuram in, and he's got to play him. So he then had to put him in and put Ben on the bench. And I think Ben was doing well at the time, so I think his head absolutely fell off. And then yeah, I think this lad Thuram come in, played, and then obviously I think I then got fit. But Ben then, in the meantime, had left. He'd gone to Leighton Orient because he didn't like what was going on. And then, to be fair to Powley, he stuck me in. He stuck me in for a cup game, which I think I did well in. And then Sheffield Wednesday in the FA Cup, I think he put me in after I'd been out for 3 months. I had a good game, and then he kept me in for the league. So I think he kind of defied the chairman's wishes to play him. So because you know, we all thought I was out of contract as well, and I really needed to be out on the pitch playing to, you know, not get myself in the shop window, but just to, you know, even to win a contract at Charlton at the time, because I was out. He then obviously went against what the chairman's wishes were, and you know, in the end, he sacked him because he wasn't playing all the these players that he wanted him to play. It was quite a crazy situation, really, if you're looking back on it.
Bonkers situation. Absolute madness to think that could actually go on. He's now, of course, sold the club, so better times for Charlton. Like you said, you know Dylan Phillips, and he's doing extremely well this season. We'll quickly move on to Huddersfield. You came in at the start of last season. Fair to say, a bit of a baptism of fire for yourself. Jonas Lerser was the recognised number one, but you got the nod after a very good pre-season. And then you go and get Chelsea and City in your opening two games.
Yeah, it's a strange, really strange, yeah, really strange experience. Obviously, went there from Leicester, made the decision to go to Huddersfield, thinking, you know, I'd have more chance of playing there. And went into pre-season and had a really, really solid pre-season, actually. I really, enjoying myself. And, the Wagner gave me a shout in Austria the week before the season started. And he said, I'm giving you the nod, I'm going to start you next week in first game. And I was like, I was buzzing, obviously. You know, the reason for the move was to actually try and get more games in the Premier League, because obviously Kasper was doing so well at Leicester, I was never really going to dislodge him. So started the season and we had Chelsea and Man City, and obviously Chelsea we got beat 3-0, and then we went Man City, and to be honest, I just made some really, really basic technical errors in the game, and you know, let goals in which weren't, you know, just weren't good enough goalkeeping, really. And you know, I held my hands up, and I didn't play well when I played for Huddersfield last season, and I think there was quite a lot of us actually that weren't good enough, and you know, it was a reason why we got relegated in the end. But you know, sometimes in football you go for these spells, and it was a really strange contrast from pre-season to then to the start of the season. And obviously I got injured in the third game, I think it was, against Cardiff, and then that was pretty much me. I was pretty much done then, because then Jonas came in and he actually did quite well. So, strange, mixed feelings with the season last year, and obviously it didn't really work out. And you know, that's obviously why I've come to Derby on loan and starting to really enjoy my football again. So every cloud.
Do you know what we're going to talk about, Doug? Because you bounced back in a big, big way. But, you know, like, I've certainly gone through periods of my career when things seemingly going against me and the crowd turned on me a couple of times, certainly at Watford towards the end. I had a 4 or 5 game spell where I just couldn't do anything right, and it was horrendous. I remember it. But when you are going through a tough time, and I remember you went and played an FA Cup game at Bristol City. So I'm guessing at the time you're going through a tough time because you're at Huddersfield and it's not gone quite how you want it to go. And then you're going up against one of your old clubs. How was that as an experience? How did you deal with a game like that?
To be fair, it was just like another game for me, really, to be honest. I remember coming, I hadn't played for a long time, so, you know, coming to the games, I'm just looking forward to playing a game. And then, you know, seemed to be going around. I remember actually taking a goal. This is what probably summed my time up at Huddersfield last season. I had a goal kick in the first half and I kicked out for a corner. And I was like, this just sums it up. I remember having a goal kick in the first half.
How did that happen, out of interest?
I've just gone to play a ball to the centre half who's come out wide, and it's come off my heel completely wrong. And I could do it 1,000 times in training and never be able to replicate it. And for some reason, I've kicked out for a corner. And at the time, the Huddersfield fans were on my back anyway. And when you do something like that, you're just never going to help yourself. Do you know what I mean? So. And then I think in that game as well, I got beat softly at my near stick as well. And I think, you know, I remember the manager, you know, getting on at me after the game about that, and you know, he's right, and you know, sometimes you just don't help yourself. Do you know what I mean? It just doesn't go right for whatever reason. And every time I played for Huddersfield last year, you know, as soon as I did something wrong, I kicked the ball out into touch. If I was trying to fall back, the fans were just getting on me, and you know, sometimes you just go through them spells, and you know, you've just got to be tough, and you know, try and get yourself through it. And you know, it will happen in your career. You go through spells like you say in there, Rich, like where things just don't seem to go right for you. And you know, I won them last year, classic example. So, but you know, I've gone to Derby and, you know, created a good first impression. I think I always believe this is how you start the first two, three, four games. You know, and it sets the tone, really. And I think at Huddersfield, I didn't set the tone right. And you know, I've come to Derby and you know, I've got off on the right foot, and you know, and that's helped me massively.
Yeah, things certainly looking up for you now, Ben. In with Keller Roos at Derby, another guy we've had on the podcast. Really seems like a top guy dedicated to his craft. But it was after that game against Fulham at the back end of November where Philip Cocu decided to change things around. He was very open about the fact that he was going to bring you in and let Keller maybe try and regain some confidence. Ever since then, you've kept the number one spot, bar FA Cup games. You've been the number one in the Championship. What's it been like working with Cocu, working with Shay Given, of course, the goalkeeper coach?
Yeah, brilliant. I mean, obviously, you mentioned there the manager and the goalkeeper coach, their careers like speak for themselves. And, you know, they were obviously great players in their positions. Obviously, the gaffer played for Barcelona for pretty much all his career. And Shay's played in the Premier League all his career. And it's really, really good to, you know, work with people like this. And, you know, Shay's been brilliant since I've been in, you know, constantly trying to improve us. And there's no let up. Don't get me wrong, we have a lot of fun. We have a lot of crack. But when we work hard. And Keller obviously started the season, and you know, absolutely great guy, Keller. Really getting well with him, and you know, but you know, like I say, we've got that healthy competition where we want each other to do well, and we're pushing each other hard and training every day. And it's a really good work dynamic there, actually. And I'm really loving my time down here in Derby. So long may it continue. But like I said, it's all about playing the games, and you know, I'm getting a lot of minutes under my belt now for the first time in the last 4 or 5 years, but getting that consistent run of games, and you know, I'm really, really, really enjoying it and really loving my football again. So it's really positive at the moment.
And of course, got to ask you, the fact that you're at Derby and Mr. Wayne Rooney has joined you there, how's it been with him settling in?
Yeah, brilliant, mate. Do you know what? Obviously, he's well known through the world of football, and you know, obviously, you know, before he's coming in, you're thinking, oh, I wonder what he's going to be like. But do you know what, mate? He just down-to-earth lad, and you know, brilliant around the place. You can tell he's up. Our level of training has gone up a hell of a lot since he's come in. He demands excellence, and the reason why he's done what he's done in his career is because his standards are so high. And even now, you know, he's doing everything to the best of his ability, and you know, do free kicks with him after training quite a lot, and you know, he's still, you know, perfecting his craft even you know, after the long career that he's had. So he's a great example for the young lads who are coming through the system at the minute at Derby. And he's a really positive influence around the training ground, and you know, obviously on the pitch as well. He scored a great goal the other night against Stoke from a free kick, and he's really lifted the place.
Classic case of a top player coming in and actually really boosting the dressing room, isn't it, Ben? I guess you must be buzzing as well. Wayne Rooney's turning around to you and saying, yeah, should we stick behind after training to practice free kicks? You're like, yep, absolutely, I'm up for that.
Yeah, 100%, mate. You know, there's your example straight away, because you know, obviously what he's done in football, you know, the young lads, you know, they're like sponges. They're, you know, watching him, and you can tell, like, you know, they're buzzing that he's there. And obviously he leads by example. And you know what, as well, he talks the game really well as well, and you know, breaks it down with his instructions for the team. And yeah, now he's a really, really good influence around the place, and we're all happy to have him here.
You do have the Champions League in common, by the way. We didn't mention that. We'll quickly touch on it. Of course, you have Champions League pedigree now, mate.
We don't talk about that, mate.
I was trying to look on the bright side of that game, Ben. The fact that you got to play in Europe. I know it was a difficult situation at the time.
Yeah, every time someone brings that up to me, oh, you played in the Champions League, and yeah, I'm like, no, who told you that? I ain't played a game all season, because Robert Zito was there, and he was on the bench all year, and I was the third choice that season. And I'm going to stall it, because we'd already qualified through the group, because we were absolutely flying. I think we won every game. And he pulled me on the Sunday, and he's like, Ames, you're playing Tuesday night. And I was like, oh, mate, I was honestly buzzing, because obviously I'd played in all the leagues. I played in the Conference League 2, League 1, Championship, Premier League, but the only one I hadn't done was the Champions League. So I was over the moon. I couldn't wait, and we got out to Porto, and I was buzzing, and you know, get out Champions League theme tune, and you're like, oh, this is all right, isn't it? Don't mind a bit of this. And then I couldn't believe I was standing there, to be honest, but you know, I was embracing everything. And then I look up at the scoreboard after about 20 minutes, and we're 3-0 down. And I was like, right, get me off this pitch now, get me off. It's great to have on your CV, but yeah, not an experience I look back on fondly, considering I was so looking forward to the game. And you know, I think we made about 10 changes that night, I think, and we just weren't at the races. And you know, they fully punished us that night. And not a great one for the memory bank, but we'll just keep on the CV, just keep the scoreline off it.
But that's got to be something. That's got to be like a quiz question there. Someone who's played. That's right. You played. What was that right? National League, League 2, League 1, Championship, Premier League, Champions League. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Wow.
Wow.
That's got to be some form. I can't imagine there's anybody else has done that, surely.
We just made one.
Yeah, good. Yeah, pub quiz, mate.
There you go.
All right, let's get in there.
Okay, Ben, we're nearing the end. Just before Richard asks his customary final question, I've got a technical question for you, and this involves your debut for Derby in the Championship against QPR, sorry, that first game that you came in for. Now, yeah. Derby were winning the game. QPR got a penalty. Eberechi Eze was the guy who stepped up for the penalty. We see a lot of players with different penalty techniques in the Championship, Lyle Taylor being one, Eze being another. Now, he did the classic run-up, he stuttered, and we know that it gets very difficult for goalkeepers. I want to ask you your opinion on this, because penalties now will be made even harder for goalkeepers, and the officials are clamping down on it. A keeper has to have at least 1 foot on the line. What's your view on strikers being able to stutter? And I know that the rule is as long as they continually move. And Eze, for crying out loud, he was very slowly dragging his foot along the floor. What do you make of penalties like this?
Mate, I absolutely despise them. I hate the lads that do it. But do you know what? I've got to applaud their bottle. You've got to have some bottle to walk up to a penalty like that, and you know, and wait for the keeper to move. So, you know, you've got to admire the player for doing it. But you know, as a keeper, you can't then get that step and push, because you really want to, you know, you want to, as they're hitting the balls, you want to be taken off and going, you know, flat out to whatever corner you're going to. So, it's really then hard. If you wait and then, you know, they pass it, it's hard for you to get that step and push. So, you know, I like the player to be running up to the ball at a normal pace, and as they're hitting it, I can then step and, you know, push as far as I can to get into that, you know, get into that far corner. But it's a tough one. I mean, there's a guy called Jorginho at Chelsea who does it as well. I remember facing a penalty against him last year, and he did this little hop, and as you then step, he then just puts it the other way. So, you know, it's so hard, because you've got to wait for that moment of impact on the ball before you actually go. And like, you know, as a keeper, you want to get a nice early dive in so you can get to the corner. So for me, it's frustrating, but you just got to admire their bottle, the players taking it.
Do you know, I had a similar, for me, it was a guy called Heider Helgeson, who was the Watford fans remember him, and he had that penalty technique. And I always thought, actually, not in training, literally hundreds of penalties, never ever saved a single penalty. And you felt like if every player could find that technique and hone it, then, you know, goalkeepers wouldn't stand a chance. But anyway, that's
it's definitely a hard one, yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah. You just got to admire him, I think, mate.
Yeah, definitely. Well, look, final question. We ask every goalkeeper this, every goalkeeper coach this, and we get a variety of different answers from, I'm trying to think, Matt, what are some of the answers we've had money, we've had happiness, we've had direction. What other answers have we had to this question I'm about to ask?
Drive.
Great sex life.
I mean, you've obviously heard the question. So the question is, Ben Hamer, what has goalkeeping given you?
Do you know what, mate? It's given me a variety of things. I mean, obviously, first and foremost, it gives me that drive to get up in the morning and go into work and improve myself, you know, just having that thing to, you know, just get you out of the house in the morning and go and try and perfect and, you know, work hard on, you know, I've met a wonderful amount of people in the game. So, yeah, it takes you around, you know, the country, and you get to meet loads of types of different people and, you know, ultimately get friends out of it, which, you know, are lifelong. And the adulation of playing 90 minutes in a stadium full of people, and, you know, that real buzz after winning a game, you know, I don't think you can really replicate it, you know, that feeling you get after winning a game of football. That's what I really long for. So yeah, I just giving me everything, really, mate, to be honest. It is a real sense of achievement for me to be doing what I wanted to do since I was a kid, and you know, a long way to continue.
Ben Hamer, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, mate.
Rangers. Morrison in front of it, finds Phillips inside the D. Phillips turns, Hamer stretches to save, and then Laurie Wilson clears it to this near side, and the ball almost hits us, Paul. And that was a strike that required a world-class save from the Charlton goalkeeper.
So how long did you spend in the company of Ben Hamer without knowing that he was fluent in German? It's an absolute disgrace. This is the problem. This is why footballers have their bad name, because all you do is play football and then you go out and you party and you have fun and you talk about all sorts. You don't get into the nitty-gritty, the deep side, the real personality of these individuals.
I know, it's sad, really. Like you say, all we do is just have loads of fun, love life, enjoy life, and never really get that deep.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, I feel bad.
Incredible. Well, not incredible. Interesting, though. Speaks fluent German.
It is interesting. He's an interesting character. For those that know Ben Hamer, really, really popular character in the world of football. For anyone that knows him, he's a bit of a free spirit. He look incredibly talented, and certainly he's showing that at the moment with what he's doing at Derby. And I saw it back in the day. You know, obviously we had a little bit back and forth on the Brentford experience, and it was a fascinating experience for both of us for different reasons. But watching him come in, he's one of the most naturally gifted goalkeepers I've ever come across, certainly.
Do you know what I like most about him was his honesty. Yeah. And you often see this with goalkeepers who are not coming to the end of his career. He's still only just over 30. But as goalkeepers progress, really noticed it with Joe Hart, very matter of fact now, kind of comfortable in his own skin. And he spoke about the scenario at Brentford when you were in goal. And he said, you know, I went into the manager's office, Andy Scott, and said, look, probably best that I just move on. He was really honest about the fact that maybe he was, I don't want to use the term big time, but he went into the Premier League with Leicester and then had that first season and was like, well, hang on a second, I should be first choice. But spoke quite honestly about that and the fact that he potentially got that wrong. And then Huddersfield, it hasn't really worked out, so he's enjoying his time with Derby. But all three instances, he was really honest, quite frank about it.
Well, he said, and he even said himself, the way in which he likes to be treated. I think most goalkeepers, in fact, most people, you know, they're like that. They'd rather just be told straight. You know, like he said, he gave the example, I think with Nigel Pearson, wasn't it? He gave the example that basically, I think the other goalkeeper is better than you. You know, and it's, don't get me wrong, it's not the nicest thing to hear when someone says that, but you'd rather that than maybe them not tell you or them going around the houses to find a way to drop you, for instance. So, look, I think I'm similar. I think most people are, but it's difficult because so many people in this world are overly nice, it feels like, a lot of the time, and they won't necessarily get to the crux of something. So, you know, look, if Nigel Pearson has said that to him and hence why he appreciated that, sometimes it's easier just to do that. Be brutally honest. And also to be brutally honest with yourself. Look, if you had a bad game of football, that doesn't mean you're a bad goalkeeper. If you had a good game of football, it doesn't mean you're a good goalkeeper. So it's being able to take emotion out of it and actually be quite assertive with other people, but also with yourself. Be able to look at your game from a bird's eye perspective almost and be able to evaluate yourself honestly. And by doing that, you'll actually find ways in which you can improve as well. One of the biggest problems that a lot of people have, not just goalkeepers, is that they won't ever necessarily get to the core of the problem. They'll try and find ways to justify it in their head or find ways to make it okay or get people to back them up where, you know, it wasn't a mistake, was it? No, 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 it wasn't your fault. It was such and such's fault. Well, actually, if it was your mistake, take responsibility and be able to move through it, find a way to move through it, and in doing so, you improve.
Curious situation as well with regards to his spell with Derby. Huddersfield, of course, Kamil Grabara looks like he's going to be out for a short while with that injury that he picked up. They ended up going for Jonas Lersel and bringing him back in on loan from Everton. Ben Hamer is on loan at Derby. He is a Huddersfield player, but he's stuck with Derby. They've gone with Lersel. He's got, what, a year or two left on his contract. Interesting to see what happens.
It is, and I think, and I understand it will be really interesting in the summer because I think the fact is he's doing brilliantly at Derby. And it's hard. If you have to go back to a Huddersfield, for instance, you're on the back foot to begin with. I had it to an extent at Brentford because I started so badly at Brentford, hence why they loaned in Ben Hamer. It took me a long period of time in order to win the fans over. The only reason I won them over was that we ended up beating, from memory, it was Hull in the Cup, who were a league above. Everton, of course, were Premier League. I then saved like 8 penalties in my first 5 games or something ridiculous. And eventually, I won them over. I didn't win over everyone, by the way, but I won them over. But in hindsight, to be in that position when you feel like you're hated, you feel like you're on the back foot, it is a long journey to get back into people's good books. So where you are at the moment, you're at a big club in Derby where they love you, you're doing brilliantly, or to go back to Huddersfield where you have to start afresh, not even starting afresh, you have to start minus steps because they already have got an opinion of you, which isn't particularly positive. I fully understand why he's fought and held his ground and fought for the fact that he wanted to stay at Derby.
Okay, Richard, thank you for another week. As I say every week, pleasurable being in your company.
Likewise, Matthew.
This has been the Goalkeepers Union podcast in association with Goalkeepers 365, GK Icon Academies and Love Sport Radio. We will see you next time.